This is IBM, the Islamic Broadcasting Network. The following program is sponsored by the Islamic Media Foundation, sharing the guidance of Allah through broadcast media and the internet.
This is a civilizational dialogue with Anisa Abdul Fattah.
Today's show. For those of us who, or for those of you who normally have been joining us on Thursdays from 2:30 to 3 o'clock p.m., here we are today, Wednesday, at 1 o'clock. And from now on, we will be broadcasting Civilizational Dialogue live from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock p.m. So I hope you will continue to join us and that you will spread the word to others who participate normally in the program or who are listeners, that the time has changed and that instead of half an hour, we are expanded to 1 hour, which is a blessing. So we have more time to spend together on Wednesday afternoons, and of course we can get a lot deeper into some of the topics that we bring to you. Today our guest is Dr. Robert Dixon Crane. Dr. Crane graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Northwestern University in 1956. He earned a JD from Howard Law School in 1959. From 1963 to 68, Dr. Crane was the personal advisor to President Richard Nixon, who appointed him the Deputy Director for Planning in the National Security Council. In 1981, President Reagan appointed him the U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. He embraced Islam in 1981, and he left the government and has since become recognized as an Islamic scholar and activist. Dr. Crane is presently the chairman of the Crescent University Foundation. He is chairman of the Center for Understanding Islam, and his most recent project is a commentary on the Quran through a juristic perspective, where he employs the universal principles of Islamic juristic thought to guide his commentary. Dr. Crane?
Yeah, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalamu rahmatullah. Thank you for being with us today. We're going to take a one-minute break, which is what we usually do at the beginning of the show, and then we're going to come back and begin our discussion. Our discussion today is going to be on the Bush 2003 legislative agenda, and Dr. Crane is also going to share with us some of his ideas, philosophic ideas, on the present administration's approach. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
If the way you dress expresses how you feel, and your dress speaks about you, then your dress not only makes a statement, but it is an important part of your identity. These are American Muslim women. Their dress reflects their faith and their belief in modesty. This message has been brought to you by your American Muslim neighbors.
This public service announcement is brought to you by the Islamic Media Foundation.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the program. This is a civilizational dialogue, and I'm your host, Anisa Abdul Fattah. For those of you who are just joining us, our guest today is Dr. Robert Dixon Crane, who is presently the chairman of the Center for Understanding Islam. He is a former Nixon advisor, and he was also former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. He is a Muslim, and he is with us today to share with us his perspective on the Bush administration's approach to domestic and foreign policy, and I think we're also maybe going to take a few minutes to discuss the 2003 legislative agenda. Dr. Crane, I want to begin our interview today, if I can, with the Bush message. I think that's a good way for us to lead into the overall discussion, because for sure people have different ideas about exactly what the Bush administration's message is. They have a domestic message and they have a foreign policy message that they've been trying to articulate since he came into office. It seems that people in the United States are getting the message. He's extremely popular here in the United States, but overseas it seems not to be getting across. Share with us your view on the overall message, and then if you would, if you would characterize the administration for us.
Inshallah, yeah, I'd be glad to. Question is, does President Bush have a coherent message, either domestically or in foreign policy? I think he does, but I'm not sure he could articulate it even to himself. In his acceptance speech at the Republican nominating convention in August 2000, he clearly stated his undoubted top priority, his personal priority. This is compassionate conservatism, which came to be embodied in his faith-based initiative. As a born-again Christian, he's convinced that God has called him to help the poor and marginalized in America. Unfortunately, he has had almost no support from his own political party in pursuing this initiative. And I was somewhat taken aback at the nominating convention when applause was enthusiastic, not about his, you know, message of outreach to minorities, but only when someone talked about cutting taxes. As a successful politician who rolls with the punches, President Bush, therefore, has essentially dropped the whole idea of the faith-based initiative in domestic policy.
Okay, so you're saying then that basically he has abandoned the faith-based initiative, but I think prior to the congressional break before Christmas, he issued an executive order that made it possible for religious organizations to participate and competition for grants to provide social services. So how do you then transfer?
Yes, he did. He gave up the legislative initiative and tried to accomplish what he could through executive orders within the executive branch. But this applies mainly to hiring people of religious organizations, hiring people of their own faith to provide services to the marginalized. It doesn't address the broad perspective of the original faith-based initiative. Now, I think he does have another faith-based initiative, which is sort of monopolizing his time and his priorities. And this is his drive to combat evil in the world. Although he doesn't like to emphasize this too publicly, this, in my view, is his new faith-based initiative. I think the attack on America's symbols of global financial and military power on 9/11 convinced him that God is calling him to save America and the world from the growing forces of evil. His initial gut reaction, which was publicized in the back pages of the Washington Post, was to call for a worldwide crusade requiring attacks on as many as 60 different countries in the world.
I think this, let's take a one-minute break because I think we're having some disturbance on the phone, and we're going to come back, and I'm going to ask you to go over that, what you just said,
okay,
again, so that we can make sure we get that we can get it into into the interview. We're going to take our one-minute break here and do a little problem solving, and then we'll come right back. I ask for your
patience. Do you enjoy IBN's programs? Do you think it's important for us to be on the air? Support IBN by making a pledge today, $1 a day, to the Islamic Media Foundation. Help IBN programs to continue by making your monthly contribution today. Pledge $1 a day online at www.ibn.net or call us to pledge over the phone at 703-241-9659. Help us continue to be your voice, the voice of American Muslims.
What can we do to stop the killing?
Thou shalt not kill.
We know what to do.
Do unto others as you would have.
Do what is right and condemn what is wrong.
Killing a person unjustly is like killing all humanity.
Some rules are not meant to be broken. They are golden.
Every one of us is precious.
Be humankind.
A message from your American Muslim neighbors.
This public service announcement is brought to you by the Islamic Media Foundation.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the show. We have today with us Dr. Robert Dixon Crane, who is presently the chairman for Understanding Islam. Unfortunately, it seems that we're having some problem on the line. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to ask our engineer if we can disengage and that if he will re-initiate the interview in 1 minute. So if you'll stay with us and we'll be back, we'll take another break and we'll be back in 1 minute.
Every day, new friends are made and old friends are drawn closer. And from time to time, friends fall in love. If it's true love, the kind that stands the test of time, then everyone celebrates. Marriage, it's worth waiting for. This message has been brought to you by your American Muslim neighbors.
This public service announcement is brought to you by the Islamic Media Foundation.
The Islamic Broadcasting Network, IBN, is seeking a reliable, energetic, full-time public relations and marketing coordinator for its Falls Church, Virginia offices. Duties include seeking sponsors, fundraising, and advertisement. Candidates must be familiar with the American Muslim community and Muslim businesses in the USA, and particularly the Washington, D.C. metro area. Excellent English, written and verbal communication skills are necessary, and Arabic is a plus. Computer literacy is a must. To apply, fax your resume to 703-241-9658. That's 703-241-9658.
Assalamu alaikum. I hope you stay with us. I want to apologize for the problems that we're having today. I don't think that we will have the disturbance, the sound interfering in the connection again. But if we do, stay with us. We're going to correct it. We're not going to give up, inshallah. We're going to have this interview today. We have with us Dr. Robert Dixon Crane, who is presently the chairman of the Center for Understanding Islam. He's a former Nixon advisor. He's also a former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. Dr. Crane, I want to apologize to you for all of the problem that we're having today.
Always helps us overcome problems, and a shaitan always poses them regardless.
Absolutely. So having said that, then we will get back to our task for the day, and that is to share some insights on the Bush administration and their present legislative agenda. I think before we were interrupted, we were discussing your interpretation of the faith-based initiative or approach to government that President Bush has taken. In my opinion, I felt that he is still very much committed to what he calls compassionate conservatism, and that the executive order that he issued prior to the Christmas break is indicative of that. But you've taken a different approach to that. Can you give us again your perspective on that?
I agree with you that he personally is just as committed as he always was. But his Republican Party on Congress has backed away from facing so-called constitutional issues, separation of church and state. So this has made it politically unproductive to pursue it. He's tried to advance the faith-based initiative as much as he can within the executive branch, but his measures are nowhere near as ambitious as what they used to be. Now, I think that, as I started to say before the gremlins got in, he is equally committed, if not more so now, to another faith-based initiative. And this was what he originally called, right after 9/11, is a worldwide crusade requiring attacks on as many as 60 different countries. This was almost immediately hushed up as counterproductive and assembling support for his unilateral initiatives against the new evil empire. Mm-hmm. His new faith-based initiative in foreign policy, quite frankly, is to attack Iraq as the new leader of the evil empire.
Okay, so then what you're saying is we have kind of what would we call it, a dichotomy. We have this claim of compassionate conservatism, but at the same time we have kind of what might be perceived as a callous approach, particularly towards, I think when you say the 66 countries, you're talking specifically about the Muslim world and
right.
particularly about Iraq. So let me ask you something, and then let's include in that maybe, too, the issue of preemptive strike and the Bush Doctrine. So can we have both compassionate and callous conservatism? I mean, how do you bring these two perceptions together?
They don't fit together. On the other hand, two or three days ago, on January 3rd, at Fort Hood, Texas, he gave a talk to the 1st Cavalry Division, which is to be the first one into Iraq. And he said that their purpose in fighting in Iraq is to liberate an entire people from an evil dictatorship. So this sort of goes beyond the ideas of protecting our oil supplies or the prices, and goes beyond weapons of mass destruction. He's now casting it in terms of compassion for the people of Iraq. Unfortunately, and this is his major problem abroad, very few people take that seriously.
And why do you think that is?
Because the United States in the past, and it isn't just the Republicans, Democrats are equally guilty, have pursued a status quo in the world with all of its injustices because the United States benefits most from the present status quo. We talk about freedom around the world, but freedom in practice in American policy often amounts to just a code word for imposing American power. We are extremely powerful. Even if we didn't want to impose our power, we would be doing it anyway, just because of our power.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major problems of the Muslims in the world is that the United States promotes democracy all over the world except in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And Jean Kirkpatrick once, several years ago, who was our ambassador to the United Nations, commented, it's ironic that we do support democracy all over the world, but never have we supported it in an Arab country.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's quite natural that people, particularly Arabs, Muslims, would question our sincerity.
Well,
our track record is not very good.
Right, but I think, and this is just my personal opinion, I'm interjecting here if you would allow me for a minute, even though I agree with you that probably is the perception, not just of the Bush administration, but of the United States in general, that just by virtue of the fact that the United States is very powerful, that it is also seen as very controlling, that our objectives are overwhelming, particularly of smaller countries, and I think this has particularly been the case in the Arab and Muslim world. But that does not pardon the leaders of those countries for subscribing to policies and things that have been, I think, probably not to the better interest of the people there. Now, I know in one discussion that you and I were having, you were saying to me that President Bush uniquely represents the American people. Could you explain to our listeners what this representation is, and is that what Muslims and Arabs in the Middle East are responding to? Are they responding to President Bush or the Bush administration as a symbol of the United States, or what they dislike most about the United States? And if they are, what is the symbolism?
Yeah, I think that President Bush is deeply, quintessentially American. I think he represents America almost as well as President Reagan did, and both were very, very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And because they represent sort of the middle America and the sort of the vision that President Reagan has and President Bush to some extent, the problem is that few people abroad and probably even very few in America have the in-depth historical and philosophical background to understand where President Bush is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Even he himself may not be aware of his roots. In my view, one must first understand American politics. I think Muslims have been on a rather fast track to understand this. but generally they focus on policies that have already been formalized, already been adopted. So it's very reactive.
Right.
There's very little attempt of proactive efforts to shape the agenda that controls policies, and even less effort or no effort to shape the background thinking that controls the think tanks and in turn controls the policies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I would say, in my own view, the Muslims and everybody else who wants to understand American policy has to go back to the fundamental difference between the Democratic and Republican parties as rooted in their opposing views of human nature.
Okay, well, can you give us a brief explanation of what those philosophies are?
Yeah, the Democrats are ideologically liberal, almost by definition, which means that they generally trust human nature as being naturally good, particularly if given the right environment. Mm-hmm. And this also is the ideology of the faith-based initiative. This faith in human nature is also why liberals want all governance to be determined by majority vote as the highest authority. Many Muslims also agree that the majority vote is the best technique of governance. One can argue, however, that absolute power of the majority vote eliminates the higher authority of God and can subject minorities, as well as everyone else, the rule of the mob is manipulated by an elite. This is why America's founders never used the word democracy. As a matter of fact, they condemned it and announced that their great American experiment was a republic. Mm-hmm. Now, the essential appeal of modern liberalism and of the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. As articulated recently by Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, who I think is one of the intellectual leaders of liberalism, is this appeal not only to faith in one's fellow human beings, but to one's instinctive desire to commit one's life to something beyond oneself. Mm-hmm. This is why both President Reagan and, at least initially, President Bush appealed to both liberals and conservatives.
Okay.
So this is one side of the American political system, the liberal side.
Okay. So you're saying that, and by your definition, then most people would assume that everyone in the United States is naturally or somehow more inclined towards being liberal. But obviously that's not true, because what we see, particularly after the recent midterm elections, was that it seemed that the people of the United States are increasingly embracing the conservative vision of the future of the United States. Now, you also kind of implied, even though you didn't exactly say, that President Bush has kind of played both sides of the fence by coming across with this ideology or perspective that would be called the compassionate type of conservatism. I think you've implied that he's been leaning actually more towards the left than what would be considered the orthodox or the more traditional right.
It's interesting that some of the pundits say that we may now be entering an era of a permanent Republican establishment in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, nothing is permanent in politics.
Right.
Now, the Republicans have an appeal to the average American. It's an historical appeal. Because they're ideologically conservative,
mm-hmm.
They do not trust humans to be good, even in the best of circumstances,
mm-hmm.
which is why they want a working system of checks and balances and representative government as distinct from the direct vote for anything. The Republicans are constitutionalists, which means they are committed to restricting the power of the people for the sake of good government. Of course, for the wealthy, this also has some obvious advantages, because it helps them make laws and maintain an entire financial infrastructure designed to facilitate the unlimited accumulation and concentration of wealth. Now, this part does not appeal to the man in the street, but the conservatism, the fear of going into the unknown in search of utopian solutions is very American. And I think this is why Americans trust the conservatives. They're not going to get Americans into deep trouble.
I think
part of the key to the conservative popularity.
But wouldn't you be willing to concede that if that's the case, then part of that is based on experience with liberalism, not necessarily some innate fear that people have of dealing with the unknown or scripting a future for the country, that a lot of, if there is a resistance or hesitancy to any further embrace a liberal vision for the future of the United States, that it is based on the population's experience, the historic experience with liberalism, and kind of the price that we've had to pay for having adopted many of their ideas and policies.
Well, we come
in the
out
past,
of a
many of them, which we are still recuperating from. If recuperating.
Well, we come
word,
out of a Cold War era,
okay,
when the extremes of liberalism were represented by communism.
Okay.
And of course, everybody knows that it was an economic catastrophe, political catastrophe, spiritual catastrophe. So, if you project the extremes of liberalism, even in America, to the further extreme, you get something that we spent, 70 years fighting.
Right.
Now, I think it's very simplistic to compare mm-hmm. Soviet communism with liberalism in America. Mm-hmm. But the principles...
Well, the whole idea is you present it as the parties being distinguished mostly by their perspective on human nature.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that the Democrats or the liberal party in the country basically believes that the human being is innately good and that if left to their own devices, that we will ultimately come to good and that we should be, in fact, pursuing some type of a utopic existence here.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm hearing you right, you're saying, on the other hand, that conservatives do not believe that and believe that only through some type of a divine authority or guidance is mankind capable of finding what would be called maybe less than a utopic existence, but some type of a just existence that's based on a rule of law.
Yeah, I think you've hit it on the head that the American people are a very religious nation, the most religious nation on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Awareness of God, Allah, and of human responsibility to a higher divine authority gave rise to the great American experiment, to America, and sustains
mm-hmm.
it even today.
Right.
Only the Republican Party can claim legitimacy as the party of the religiously committed.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the religiously committed, particularly the Christians, do not trust human nature.
Well, and maybe we should say this, too, because most people would perhaps say that it's the Democrats who don't trust human nature, and that's why they believe that we should have these humongous governments that control almost every aspect of the individual's life, that we need the government to tell us how to raise our children, we need the government to tell us how to do and what to do just about everything. To me, it seems that that would indicate that actually they don't trust human nature, and that on the other side of that, we have the conservative policy, and I'm employing your definitions of their
mm-hmm.
philosophy, that on the other side, we have the conservative party that's saying, well, the same thing, actually, that it says in the Quran and also in the Bible, that the human being is inclined towards what is easy. And unfortunately, sometimes what is easy is not necessarily what is best. And so when we fall outside of the divine guidance and we're left only to our own devices or only to reason, that we will be inclined towards a life dictated by our desires, which, when they are not enlightened, can lead us to some pretty dark places.
Yeah, the Democrats traditionally have been the party of big government. The federal government is the best decider of what's good for the people, and usually it costs a lot of money to do what's best for the people. So you can say that in practice,
mm-hmm.
big government has been a burden, a political burden. On the Democratic Party,
right.
The difference, I think, is again this definition of human nature, the Rousseauian vision that utopian view of human nature,
mm-hmm.
Versus the Hobbesian view. Hobbes thought that that life is short and brutish, and the only way to make people be good is an authoritarian government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this other view, I could call it the Republican view, distrusts big government.
Mm-hmm.
But it distrusts big government to do things for the people.
Mm-hmm.
As a former leading authority on Soviet and Chinese law, I concluded that the principal hallmark of their system, this communist system, was a desire to proactive impose on people what's good for them.
Right.
Whereas the American system distrusts imposing anything on anybody, no matter how good it is. On the other hand, the Americans, and particularly the conservatives again, distrusting human nature, believe that there is a need for a strong police system and for a strong security infrastructure and power worldwide in order to prevent bad people from doing bad things.
So
it isn't so much
that
we want to impose anything on anybody. We want to prevent other people from imposing something on us and not anybody else.
Okay, so you're taking then, I think that probably that is a post 911 analysis.
Yes, it is, very much
okay,
so.
That you're saying that post 911, what we see coming out of the Conservative Party is this idea that we need a strong authoritarian government in the United States, not only in the United States, but in the world, and that the objective of that government then should be to prevent any type of attack or harm to the United States, and that this type of what you refer to as what kind of a police state is necessary as a matter of defense or protection.
Yeah, you could say that both in domestic policy and foreign policy.
Okay, is that extreme? Would you consider that form of it? I mean, your characterization might
be
extreme.
The extreme, I mean, you always have to worry, you shouldn't take it too far, but you always have to worry about what happens if a particular trend goes too far and it becomes extreme. If it goes too far domestically in the United States, we'll have a police state. If it goes too far internationally, we'll have a global police state underpinned by unilateral American initiatives.
Okay, so whereas in the past, let's say pre-911, we would have one definition of conservatism, which you think would have appropriately or would have aptly been cast upon the Republican Party, would have been this ideal pursuit of a limited government, limited taxation, free market economy, all of those things. But post 911, we're seeing something else. During one of our conversations, you mentioned a paper that had been presented or written, I believe it was a paper or article written by Henry Kissinger, where he mentioned the concept or the idea of New World Order. Is that right? You want to go into that a little bit and explain to our listeners?
Yes, I've been following Henry Kissinger for 40 years. He rarely initiates policy, but he always ends up on the winning side. He sort of represents the consensus of what I call the permanent foreign policy establishment, both Democrats and the Republicans. And on August 12th, he published an article entitled... what was it? Our intervention in Iraq, how a preventive war could lead to a new international order. This is in the Washington Post. It was a full-page thing, which is it's undoubtedly a background position paper, which he published in order to sort of clear the air so everybody will know that there will be a war against Iraq. The only question is under what circumstances can the UN be involved to sort of lend a fig leaf for our unilateral initiative. He didn't mention it, but others have. Can we attack Iraq without simultaneously addressing the injustices in Palestine?
Mm-hmm.
And his position was that the purpose of attacking Iraq is not just to the exotic one of eliminating weapons of mass destruction. It's not just the mundane one of maintaining oil prices.
Mm-hmm.
It goes beyond that to developing an entirely new international law. For the first time, he used the word New World Order. Back in 91, when President Bush used that, Kissinger said we shouldn't use it. It's unrealistic. The world is still a balance of regional powers. There can be no New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the first time, he's adopted it. Not only can there be a new world order, there must be in the era of loose weapons of mass destruction.
A proliferation of
nuclear proliferation, weapons of mass destruction proliferation,
mm-hmm.
and of rogue states.
Mm-hmm.
And a rogue state, a state by definition, is a state that thumbs its nose at the United States. he once made the statement that if a world power does not crack down on middle powers that get uppity, it will no longer be a super state.
Right.
It must crack down harder. And if somebody attacks us, we have to attack much harder.
Mm-hmm.
And this is his whole strategic framework.
Right.
So, and he made it very clear that we cannot wait very long to attack Iraq, because the longer we wait, the greater the chance that when we attack, he will be able to counter with weapons of mass destruction.
I see.
So we have to he said we have to attack as soon as possible. Others said, no, let's do a few other things first.
All right. Okay,
and
well,
we've been doing a few other things, but I think we're about at the end of them.
Okay, well, you're saying the article appeared back in August. That was prior to, I think, the weapons inspections.
Prior to what?
What, that was prior to the reinitiation of weapons inspections in Iraq?
Yes, it was prior to that. Yeah, well, see, this is one of the big debates in the White House, and Secretary Powell won out.
Mm-hmm.
He said, at least let's see what we can get from the United Nations politically, if not actual help in removing the weapons of mass destruction without a war.
Right. My point being that that might be Henry Kissinger's position, but that's not necessarily an administration.
Well, see, the administration position turned out to be Secretary Powell's.
Mm-hmm.
He was not against that. As a matter of fact, it's just a question of whether we want to make the United States subject to international decisions. The United States, he said, has to maintain the right of unilateral initiative, and whenever we don't get what we want from the international community for our own self-defense, we have to act unilaterally, whatever has to be done.
Which is a theory. And if that's someone's position or their theory and they publish it, it just means that it's something to be considered. It doesn't mean, and the reason I'm making this distinction is because we opened the program talking about the Bush administration's message and how it is received.
Mm-hmm.
And I think particularly within the Muslim community, we have this tendency to always perceive it negatively.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you make these statements about Kissinger's article and his perspective on attacking Iraq and the benefits he would see to that, to American authoritarianism or power or the New World Order, that, you know, we make it clear that that's Henry Kissinger's position and his opinion that's being published, that it's not necessarily the administration's policy.
But the so-called opposing positions were not really opposing it. For example,
mm-hmm.
Secretary of State George Shultz, in the January 26th issue of the Washington Post, 2002, published a position paper equally significant entitled Terror in the States.
Okay.
This was designed to legitimate unilateral action by the United States against sovereign states on the basis of their accountability in the war against terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
He said, in other words, he said, sovereign states no longer have sovereign rights if they interfere with the war against terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
I pay attention to people like that. I consider them the core parts of the permanent establishment.
Well, I think that probably most of us do, and I think that they should be considered that way. But my point is, again, is that even if their opinions are influencing policy, that they are not necessarily dictating.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That
this is one of the main points that I always make, particularly to Muslims. They sometimes have a sort of a paranoid view of the U.S. government. They conclude it's a massive monolithic institution. You can't possibly influence it. And proof of that is that whenever the Muslims...
And it is perpetually embroiled in some kind of conspiratorial scheme against Muslims in the Arab world.
Right,
and
I think
that is also very disempowering for us.
And then the Muslims fail to influence the policy, and they say, well, that proves that... It's a conspiracy, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
My experience in the government, and I've been in the executive branch, and I've advised three presidents and four cabinet officers, the personal advisor to them, and also the minority leader of both the House and Senate. And I've found consistently that regardless of the issue, the debates are intense on both sides or all sides. The question is, how can one weigh in most effectively on what we would call an Islamic position, which in my view is promoting justice And justice, by definition, is human rights for ourselves and others.
Okay, let's take a one-minute break, and then let's come back and explore that idea a little further. I also want you to talk for a minute, if you can. You mentioned in Kissinger's article that he brought up the issue of Palestine in respect to our potential attack on Iraq. When we come back, I want you to, if you would, to go further.
Okay.
So we'll take a one-minute break, and we'll be right back.
These are the mothers of the world. They raise every new generation. They...
Excuse me, pardon me.
Yes?
What about the nagging?
Nagging?
Take off the garbage. Do your homework.
She's helping you build good character, teaching you things like responsibility, trustworthiness, honor, compassion, integrity.
Okay.
And because she loves you.
I know you're gonna say that.
Kindness to mothers is a gateway to paradise. Have you shown her love today? This message has been brought to you by your American Muslim neighbors.
This public service announcement is brought to you by the Islamic Media Foundation.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to A Civilizational Dialogue. I'm Anissa Abdel Fattah, and we have with us today Dr. Robert Dixon Crane, former advisor to President Richard Nixon, former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, and he is presently the chairman of the Center for Understanding Islam. Dr. Crane, prior to the break, we were discussing people whose ideas significantly impact American policies, both domestic and foreign policies, and we were talking specifically about a paper that was published, written by Henry Kissinger and published, I think you said, in the Washington Post. I think you also said that within his article he was discussing a potential Iraq attack on Iraq in respect to the situation in Palestine. Many Muslims have also, not only Muslims, but many people have raised the issue that have linked these two things. That's what I want to say. They have linked the situation in Palestine to the situation in Iraq. Are you implying that Henry Kissinger also did that? And if so,
you misunderstood me. Henry Kissinger never mentioned a link to justice in the Middle East to Palestine.
Okay.
This was brought out 2 days later in a counter position paper.
Mm-hmm.
On CBS's Face the Nation by Brent Scowcroft. He's another of the real insiders.
Okay.
Has been since the Nixon administration. He's a decades-long close associate of Kissinger and was Kissinger's choice as director of the National Security Council in the White House under both Presidents Ford and Bush.
Mm-hmm.
So one has to listen carefully to what he says.
Right.
He countered Kissinger's position paper in the Wall Street Journal of August 15th by arguing that Saddam Hussein seeks weapons of mass destruction not to arm terrorists, but to deter us from intervening to block his aggressive designs against his neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And he said direct action right now to counter this threat could undermine the effectiveness of America's other top priority mission to counter the proven threat of non-state terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
He promoted the attack later policy. I mean, he certainly said attack, but not quite now. And he said that and I can quote him, actually. He said, possibly the most dire consequences would be the effect in the region of an attack without prior preparation, political preparation. And he says, the shared view in the region is that Iraq is principally an obsession of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The obsession of the region, however, is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If we were seen to be turning our backs on that bitter conflict, there would be an explosion of outrage against us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, see, this is the counter position, which was argued at great length, and it won out in theory.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see that the United States has ever done anything significant in addressing one of the root causes of terrorism before we go ahead and attack Iraq.
I see. So you think one of the root causes of terrorism is the conflict, the Palestine-Israeli conflict?
It's sort of a symbol of the powerful against the weak. It's a symbol of Actually, I don't like to get into the Israeli Arab Israeli Palestinian conflict because I think it detracts from larger issues of whether U.S. policy can maintain independence from the corruption by special interest groups, or even whether the religion of Judaism can remain independent of corruption by extremists, by secular Zionists in its midst.
I think where I was going with that was prior to the break, we had talked about the idea of the American foreign policy or the conservative idea of authoritarianism. And I think that what you were implying, maybe I'm wrong, is that it was innately unjust and that perhaps the discussion on Iraq highlighted the fact that it is unjust in some way because we are neglecting the Palestine-Israeli conflict and opting instead to deal with Saddam Hussein, who may not, you know, be worthy of the amount of attention that he's receiving. So I'm going back now to this whole concept of New World Order, authoritarianism, mm-hmm. and justice. You said that our preoccupation with Iraq is not based on oil, and neither is it weapons of mass destruction, but it has more to do with our desire to have this strong authoritarian type of United States kind of dictating.
Which is completely incompatible with the traditional Republican position, certainly incompatible with the Founding Fathers. George Washington, in his final address, said that the United States at all costs should beware of entangling alliances whereby a foreign alliance controls American policy. I think that President Eisenhower, in his final address, said that we should beware of the power of the military-industrial complex because there's a vested interest in building weapons.
Right. So then, I
used to work in the think tanks, and one of my jobs was to develop scenarios to sort of justify weapons. What kind of conflict could we possibly get into around the world that would justify a big military? And then I would invent these scenarios that, would require us to be a military superpower.
Right. So then, if we go back,
vested interest.
Right. But if we go back then to our original question, and I want to do that because I want us, we have maybe about 10 minutes left in the program, and I wanted to spend that time with some discussion on an assessment, your assessment of Bush's economic plan as
right.
was presented yesterday. So to round up this part of our conversation that goes back to our initial question as to how the administration's message is being perceived among Muslims here in the United States perhaps, but certainly among Muslims in the Arab and Muslim world. And if I tell me if I have grasped what you are saying.
Well, are you referring to foreign policy or specifically to the recent economic plan that was announced?
No, I haven't got to the economic plan yet.
Okay.
I wanted to kind of give our listeners some closure on this part of our of our discussion. Maybe then what I should ask you to do is to kind of sum up what it is that your initial response to the question, what is the message that's being perceived by Muslims and Arabs, which I think we have both agreed is a message that the United States is pursuing some type of a post-911 authoritarianism. I wouldn't go so far as to call it a policing, but of course I think we do see the role of the United States as being one that would be a lot more pronounced than previous.
Well, there was always a trade-off between security and civil rights and freedom. There always has been, always will be.
So then internationally, would civil rights be representative of justice? Are we talking about justice again?
I'm talking about the rights of human beings all over the world, the rights of human beings in the United States.
Okay.
The rights and the responsibilities are the same.
Okay.
And I think every religious system teaches that. When practical politics suggests that we tilt to one side in favor of security at the expense of civil rights or at the expense of international institutions, we may start down a road towards to the extreme, whereby the United States becomes a Darth Vader of the world.
Right.
That's about as extreme as you can get, but it's not out of the question.
Right, and it's not the policy at this time, would you say?
Definitely not. But I'm concerned that, let's say the United States does not address the inequities in the world. Mm-hmm. Let's say there are a lot more terrorist incidents, a lot worse than 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Would the U.S. people, the American people, would the U.S. government be able to resist the temptation to do what we did to the Japanese Hiroshima? Could we resist it? That concerns me. And I think that the Muslims have an obligation to help Americans maintain perspective on issues of justice.
And how do we do that?
Well, we do that by first being clear on what justice is. The Maqasid al-Sharia, the universal principles of Islamic law,
mm-hmm.
Spell out what human rights are in a sophisticated code unlike anything that's ever been developed since. This has to be applied toward U.S. policies, but not merely to explain what's good for Muslims, but to explain what is good for America. I once talked to the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and I said, if there were Muslim think tanks which would address issues from the point of view of what's best for America, would you listen to them?
Mm-hmm.
And his eyes lit up, and he said, that would be fantastic. I deal every day in both the legislative and executive branch with issues that concern Muslims. I've never seen a Muslim involved.
Yeah.
And he said, but nobody would listen to them if all they're doing is trying to promote their own interests. We don't care about their interests. We care about America. If that's what they're concerned about, we'll listen to them.
Right.
And this is what Americans have to learn. American Muslims have to learn to do.
Well, I think that probably you and I would both agree, and I'm saying that because we've had discussions previous to this one where we both kind of agreed that probably one of the greatest disservices that Muslim organizations did to Muslims in this country was that in their efforts to galvanize the community around certain issues, is that they selected issues that were not necessarily the best issues for introducing a community into the mainstream,
mm-hmm.
that they were kind of marginalizing issues.
There were self-serving issues.
Right.
And, the political activists among the Jews have self-serving issues, and they seem to get away with it. But I don't think that is the best approach. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran said that we should always take the best approach in everything.
Right.
And the best approach is not just to be concerned about yourself. You have to be concerned about yourself, your community.
Right.
But you have to think of something beyond yourself. That's mm-hmm. the way you appeal to people, appeal to Americans. And that's what President Reagan did. That's what President Bush did in his faith-based initiatives.
Well, I think, too, another problem has been is that Muslims have not seen themselves as part of. And I think that when you don't feel that you are part of, then
mm-hmm.
it's hard to see that your interest is included with the interest of your neighbor,
mm-hmm.
or with the other.
Now, that's understandable for people who come from foreign countries.
Right.
But their children,
mm-hmm.
Fortunately, are as American as anybody else, if not more so.
Right.
They understand how to work within the society, how to appeal politically to a mass audience, not just to their own constituents.
Right.
This, I think, is the future of Islam in America.
Right.
And
well, I hope
the faster
that it will
we
be,
can
that we won't become
help
a special
our young
interest
people.
Group or a special interest community. I hope that we will avoid that. I've only got a few minutes left, and I really want you to give me your assessment of the economic plan, the economic stimulus package that the president introduced yesterday.
Okay. Well, as far as I'm concerned, this is just a revival of supply-side economics. President Reagan introduced this in the early 80s. His advisors said, you're going to break the bank. You're going to introduce enormous deficits, inflation, and that's exactly what happened. But politically, it made sense at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to some extent that's what's happening now. About a quarter of the stimulus package is in tax cuts. Now, my principal, I can go into the details, but my principal problem with the core of the new tax stimulus plan or economic stimulus plan is eliminating all taxes on dividends.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm all in favor of eliminating the double taxation of dividends, but this should be part of a broader program to change the banking, the credit infrastructure of America in order to broaden ownership of stocks. This has not been done. I mean, if the majority of Muslims owned the tools where they work, had some stock in the companies where they work, then eliminating dividends would promote justice. But when there's extreme concentration of ownership of stock, as there is, then reducing, eliminating the dividend taxes helps the rich and doesn't help at all the vast majority of the American people. In other words, this is only half, the stimulus package, as far as the dividends is concerned, is only half of what needs to be done.
In that respect. Okay. We have a State of the Union address coming up.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the president's message will be?
Well, his economic plan yesterday or day before yesterday addressed domestic issues. His State of the Union message reportedly is going to be almost entirely on foreign policy. It's scheduled for January 28th. The previous day, the 27th, the United Nations will issue its formal report on the inspections, and the indications are that they will verify material breach, which is a code word for attack. And so I think probably, unless something really important happens between now and then, he will justify his imminent attack.
Oh, okay. Well, I just want to say, for our listeners' benefit, is the president has not said that there's going to be an imminent attack.
No.
And that he has said that he will make that decision when the time comes. I want to thank you for being with us today, Dr. Crane. I want you to come back and be with us again.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation. You're a great conversationalist.
Well, thank you very much. And I want to thank our listeners for being with us. This has been a civilizational dialogue. And I'm Anisa Abdul Fattah. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you again, Dr. Crane.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This program has been sponsored by the Islamic Media Foundation, sharing the guidance of Allah through the broadcast media and the internet.